This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Hey, welcome to this week's podcast. We got an amazing show for you all the way from New York City. It's comic writer and performer Ross Bennett. Ross, it's so good to hear your voice. It's been a mere 35 years. How are you doing, buddy?
I would say the last time we probably had any contact would have been around 1990, 91, something around there.
Yeah, it's been a while, but you know what's great is we're both, well, I'm tickling my toes in the business, but you're still an active entertainer, and that's so impressive.
Oh, thanks. I was just pulling out. Do you have your old booking calendars and stuff like that?
Yes. In fact, I found some stuff from 85 and 86 with you coming in.
Yeah. The first time the first thing I have in my calendars was the week of March 25th, 1981.
Wow. That was, we had just opened in 1980. That was early on.
Yeah. And it might have been, I might have had a gig in 1980, but my 1980 calendar is, it doesn't look like it kept good notes in it. I was drinking a bit.
Yeah, so, well, it's been a bit.
But that was, I first came in when you had the original location, having to do with a hotel or a restaurant or something.
Right, we were the basement of the Delta Queen restaurant in Old Sacramento.
That's right.
Go ahead.
Then you shifted over to that other place.
And the Firehouse Alley location, which I considered the best and main room. And then after that, we moved up to Front Street. So we've had a few different locations, but all in Old Sacramento. You have a great memory, Ross.
When I first came up, I was just on the phone with Bruce Smirnoff. Bruce, literally, he said, "Tell Scott I send my love." That's what he said. And I've never heard Bruce say that about anybody. So whatever you guys got going on, you know, that's none of my business.
Well, Uncle Brucey and I have quite the history as well. And we had a chance to interview him on an earlier podcast.
But he was telling me that.
We haven't had a chance, Ross, to talk in a while. And I'd love to hear a little bit about your feelings on stand-up as an art form, how you got into it. I know that that it was about 1977, 1978?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I was in college, and, you know, show business is sort of where I wanted to be, but my father, there was no way that I wouldn't have known how to say it, okay? And I graduated high school in 73, and I went to the University of Florida, and I was just lost there, and I ended up dropping out and enlisting in the Army in November of 73, literally 47 years ago this month right now. Right about.
Wow.
And my time in the Army, one thing led to another, and I ended up being a cadet at West Point. Okay?
You went to West Point. Now, that's not for slackers. That's the high end for the military.
Yes, but, you know, I watched a documentary on PBS maybe 15 years ago on the history of West Point. And they actually said, of course, in the mid-70s, our standards got a little bit lower.
Did it say that?
They actually said it because they had more difficulty getting people to go. And so, you know, things like drugs and various other behavioral problems were a little more present there.
Well, that was the end of the Vietnam era. We were all... I was actually in the draft for 2 years. You were able to avoid the draft by joining...
I didn't have to worry about it.
Okay.
My year, they didn't even, people born in 54, they drew numbers, but they never went. People born in 55, they never drew numbers. Okay. And like within a year or two, the draft was, and then the next year, I think they had eliminated it. But so, and while I was a year before I went to the academy, I was at the West Point Prep School in Fort Belvoir, Virginia. And they had a talent show, and that's the first time I did stand-up. That would have been probably around April of 75. Okay.
Yeah, but just being a West Point cadet and then also doing a little comedy, I mean, that's got to be a unique audience.
I don't know. You know, even then, I never thought about that. All I ever thought about, Scott, and it's the same thing I thought about when I worked at your club, same thing I think thought about a week and a half ago when I did a show at a winery, okay? I just want to go up and kill, okay? Whether I succeed or not, that's my goal. And that's the way it was from the very first show I did. I went up and I wanted to get big laughs, and I was always swinging for the fences.
Well, you've obviously had a lot of success to have had a career that spans that many decades. You cannot continue and last that long in this business without being funny.
So what happens is I resigned from the Academy in 77, and I started to pursue this. I went to South Florida, and I went to theater school for a year. But then in March of 78, I made the big break, went up to Chicago, and there was some showcase rooms, some workshops in the suburbs of Chicago. One was called the Comedy Room, one was called the Comedy Cottage. I was up there. 6 months later, I'm out in San Francisco doing the competition, the third competition in 79. I got into the semis, and by January of 79, I moved to L.A. That's when I would have hooked up with you, because when the boom started to happen, you know, Scott, my take on what we went through, okay, two things. Number one, my grandfather spent like a year and a half in vaudeville, okay? He was, and then he'd had enough, and he left. He actually he went in, got on two vaudeville tours, and goes, I'm done with that. And
tested
the
waters
home,
and moved on, right.
He didn't have a burning need to do this. People who stay in it like I do, it serves some other purpose, okay? I always wanted to be in vaudeville. Everybody I watched on TV, you know, Ed Sullivan's show, they were all basically vaudeville acts or vaudeville style acts. I always sort of was upset or disappointed that I wasn't in vaudeville. Then I realized a few years ago, stand up in the 80s was vaudeville, you know, working for six nights, doing 10 shows. That was vaudeville.
Very similar, yes.
Yeah, and just pounding it out, show after show after show. And that's why a lot of guys in my generation, we can really do a good job because we had it drummed into us, okay? Because we did so many shows.
But I don't mean to interrupt, Ross, but you also you on the entertainer side and me on the producer side, caught that wave right when it kicked off, 79, 80. When I opened Laughs Unlimited, it was the 12th club in the country, full-time comedy club. And by, you know, 5 years later, they felt like it was on every street corner. But we caught the beginning of that wave. And if you were performing by 1979 and getting on stage, you were definitely part of that initial wave, working with people like Leno and Saget and all the guys.
Two things. Number one, I've looked at what happened at that time. And all the guys moving to L.A. because, you know, it's being like the gold rush, okay? The gold rush, people around the country were hearing that there was gold in like 1849 out in California, and they just dropped everything to go out and try their luck at getting some of that gold. The same thing happened like in the mid to late 70s. There was like rumblings in this country that something was going on. And all these people, like myself and like Bob Saget, you know, you can go through the whole list of the people who came out of that time. We all gravitated to either New York or Los Angeles, and that was our gold rush.
I was just going to say, and you had the unique opportunity being an East Coast guy. You were working the improv both in New York and in L.A. You were working clubs out of San Francisco. Go ahead.
No, I wasn't. I was not a New York City act, okay? I had gone to Chicago. I did not go to New York City. From there, I went to San Francisco a little bit, then I was out in L.A. And I didn't go to New York to perform regularly until 2000. I actually went there in the middle. I actually went there 20 years. I came to this area 20 years ago to reinvigorate my career.
I was still working. Right. But your roots were from the East. So you started off as a West Coast comic, and then in 2000 switched over.
I born and raised my younger years in a small town in Western New York State, nothing like Manhattan. I was in Florida for a number of years. But I was never a New York City guy. And I remember being in L.A. at the Comedy Store in around 1980 when these New York acts started to come out. And they were fully formed. Here I was trying to figure out how to do this shit. And I remember Seinfeld coming out fully formed, you know, just prepared.
Oh yeah.
And George Wallace,
Larry Miller, Belzer. Mark Schiff.
Yes, exactly.
There was a whole group of them that came out from New York all in that same year, and they all had huge success. But as you mentioned, they came out having already somewhat honed at least the beginning of their sets, their material on the rough stages in New York, and came to LA somewhat already vested. And you were coming up from San Francisco and LA from more just getting started at that time.
My attitude was, I'm going to have to get, well, I have to get good someplace. And wherever I get good, if I get out to LA, it's going to take me another year, 2 years to work into the LA scene. So I said, I might as well go to LA and work on getting good there. Of course, I already had like a 10-minute act, okay? I had an act that was good enough to get me into the semifinals of the San Francisco Comedy Competition. I had an act that was good enough that when Bud Freeman saw me, he took me right over to the Red Book, made me a regular, gave me a spot. I had an act that was good enough that I could kill at the Comedy Store. And when Mitzi called me over, she said, don't let that fool you, you're not funny.
Did she really?
Oh, brutal.
She was brutal, but I haven't heard it quite like that.
She told two things. She told Dennis Miller, she didn't pass him. She goes, you should wear a sweater. That was her comment to Dennis Miller. And to the great ventriloquist, David Strassman. David is, auditioned for her, you know, with Chuck Wood, did a great, you know, killed. And she goes up and he tells the story. He goes, she said, we don't use prop acts. And then he goes, I go outside and I'm lamenting my situation. I'm standing in front of the Comedy Store and I look to my right and there is a U-Haul truck and Gary Mule Deer is pulling garbage cans full of props out of the U-Haul to take into the Comedy Store to perform. I tell comics that I work with today, because I teach a class in New York, that we have no control over who's going to like us. Our job is to do the best we can. And I always say, go where the sun is shining. Oh, turn to where the sun is shining. Go where the love is. You know, whatever's supposed to happen will happen. The guys who are miserable are the ones who say to themselves that I have to be, I have to get, so I'm working at the comic strip. I'm happy to be working at the Comedy Store or whatever. And when they don't get it, they become obsessed with it, and it just wears them out.
Well, yeah, but you also bring up a good point about how Mitzi, on the wave of the wind, could change on what she liked and didn't like. I mean, Dennis Miller would not have been any funnier or less funny with or without a sweater. I mean, that was just an obtuse thing to mention. She also, you know, saying that she didn't like prop comics, well, she might not have when it was Strassman, but that she did when it was Mule Deer. And it was, again, her flipping. Dennis Strassman was one of the best ventriloquists we had come through the club. And Gary Mule Deer was very funny as well. But for me as a producer, and of course, Mitzi was much, much more powerful and made careers. But to be, I've always heard how harsh she could be and how her judgments could change so easily, you know, minute to minute.
I've been told. I mean, I got to know her some. I got married to my wife on the main room stage of the Comedy Store. And
did you really?
It was covered by Two in the Town and Entertainment Tonight. It was a thing down there.
Well, you had to have been in her good graces to let you do that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. She said that she would never be disingenuous with somebody. If she didn't see it, she didn't want to encourage somebody who didn't have it.
I could see
what,
that.
What she did, who didn't have what she, you know, didn't have what she thought they should have.
I could see that. And, I mean, I did a lot of open mics and I would give advice and I rarely, but sometimes told somebody, you know, this isn't just, you know, maybe your thing, But normally it would be, it wouldn't be about what to wear, but it would be about presentation, material, you know, learning the art of interacting with the audience or pausing at the right time. I mean, it was technique as opposed to judgment calls on their future. It was just trying to help them to get through that set, you know, or what, yeah, what might take them to the next set and help them.
What happens is these folks, after they've seen 500-600 acts, and if some, they feel obligated to say something. If they feel obligated to make some sort of a comment. They feel obligated to make some sort of a criticism in order to justify whatever, you know, for the fact that they don't. But the truth is, it's just, you just don't do it for them. They don't see it, you know? And you just got to be willing and able to move on.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting. Now, we've kind of jumped ahead a little bit. You got your start doing an open micer while a cadet at West Point. You went on to doing some work in San Francisco and L.A. as a showcase comic opening act. I know that you were a regular at the Improv. Bud Friedman obviously saw some potential there. How many years?
Well, like I say, it was one of those things. You know, I just knocked it out of the park, and I immediately started to work there, and it took me about 6 months to get Mitzi to come around. And
the point was, you got the bug.
Oh, and the thing is, I'd had it before. I didn't know I'd had it, you know, but I'd had it before. I'd wanted to do it ever since I was a kid. But I used to have a line in my act. I didn't know how would I tell my father. My father was a Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel.
Oh my gosh! Really?
In the reserve. My joke always was, he spent 28 years in the Marine Corps Reserve. If you spend 28 years in the Marine Corps Reserve, what that means is you want to be in the real Marine Corps, but your wife won't let you.
Well, there's probably some truth to that. But having a Marine Corps colonel as a father had to be kind of a tough way to grow up, at least in the sense that he was probably thrilled to death when you went to West Point, but probably not so thrilled when you left to do comedy.
I have said in the years since his death, he's been dead almost 30 years, that maybe I might have gone to the academy just because I knew it would crush his soul when I left. Okay,
that's so bad, but true. Probably
he did live long enough to see me do what I do and do it well.
Well, that's good.
He lived long enough to see me make a living at this thing.
Good.
And that was cool.
Yeah. Well, our relationship with our fathers is always interesting. We're always trying to get approval, and a lot of us go about it the wrong way. My dad was a traveling salesman, and my whole life has been sales one way or the other. I mean, even as a producer of comedy clubs, I was selling the clubs and selling myself as the MC and selling the shows each and every night. So there is some we learn from our parentage and take that forward. But it sounds like, well, I know that you had a lot of success. Now, after coming out to L.A., do you remember did you showcase for me, or did I see you down in L.A.? Because I was going down regularly.
I'm fairly certain that somebody recommended me.
Okay.
And I went up, and I went up as an opening act, and I was always, I told Bruce this earlier, when the club started to open in 79, and I saw that, you know, openers got $150 or $200, and middles got $300 or $400, and headliners got $1,200 and up. I said, so I immediately set my sights on being a comedy club headliner. And within 2 years, I was a comedy club headliner.
Yeah.
And at this point in my life, I wish I had set my sights higher. You know, because once I had achieved that goal, I didn't have, you know, management is really people who see a massive future for you, or the potential of a massive future. And I didn't have a person like that. Okay. I was my own manager, if you will. And the only goal I knew how to set for myself was being a comedy club headliner. Well, and I did that.
And you succeeded, though, in getting some TV as well. I know you were on Evening at the Improv about 4 times, and I know you did a number of other talk shows and comedy showcases. I mean, there was some exposure nationally to your entertainment.
I've done okay, and I did get to do Letterman. I did Letterman in 2013. I'll tell you, I was 58 years old. I believe I was the oldest person to do a first-time appearance on a show like Letterman or The Tonight Show. Okay. Well,
I saw the set and you tore it up. You did a great job.
It was a great night. And, you know, I've had a lot of, let's just say, mental challenges over the years. And I was talking to Bruce earlier, that any limitations I've had in my career are things that I put on myself. I didn't know I was putting it on myself, but I put it on myself. And when I look at someone like Seinfeld and Leno, these are guys who had no limits that they placed on themselves. There was like, there was no lid like, oh, I should only be able to make $50,000 a year or only $100,000. These guys looked at anything was possible. And I admire them for that. You know, I really do. They were just wonderful.
Yeah, it is how you prepare and the goals you set. Now, I remember vaguely, and I mentioned this in an email to you, and you didn't respond, so maybe you will on the podcast. You were trying to invigorate or have some fun with your comedy writing and your set, and I remember you coming in as Eddie Strange.
Well, what happened was my wife, she passed away in 1986.
Oh my gosh, she had to have been so young. I'm sorry to hear that. This is the one you got married to. This is the one you married.
On the Comedy Store stage.
So getting married on the Comedy Store stage is a amazing opportunity and thing to have in your history.
It was fun.
But to lose your wife, a couple years later it had to have been.
Well, you're going to hate me telling you this, but I feel compelled to do it. In what would be May of 86, I was scheduled to be at your club like the first week of June or the last week of May. And as Jan was getting sicker and sicker, I called up you and I had to cancel the gig. And you were not happy. and I told you, I said, Scott, I said, I got to cancel this. My wife is sick. And you were not, and you go, okay, there's a lot of problems for me. And then the last thing you said was, all right, buddy, you owe me one.
Nice and sympathetic. Well, I'm sure I wasn't aware of how sick she was. I'm so sorry that Jan passed.
I know that's the case, but I on these things, I feel compelled often to say the truth, you know, to say it because, you know, we're all human beings and it's a challenging thing. You know, these lives that we live.
But right. And at the time, my focus was making sure there was an entertainer for the audiences that were coming in. I wasn't aware or, to be honest, all that concerned about your issues. I mean, okay, you got a sick wife. Now, what next? You know, that sounds really cold, but I've tried to express to the podcast audience that even though I love the art form, I was also deeply engrossed in the business aspect of it.
Sure.
And it was a balance of business art.
Because this is such a personable business and the people who are involved in it on stage and off tend to have outgoing, friendly personalities. At least they have that portion of themselves they can at least do on stage or as a salesman, you know, you've got your sales face and everything. And that's just the nature of the business. What happens is as an entertainer, you think that, particularly if you're immature the way I was, you thought that these relationships, you thought that people being nice to you, who you were working for, was a friendship, or, you know, that it was more than that. There was more, somehow there was more than that. And but the truth is, all you got to do is fuck up once, and it's like, you know, and that's it. And I had some of those things happen over the years, you know.
Well, that happens to everybody. Let me sidestep real quick and tell you that I owned and managed a chain of comedy clubs and restaurants for over 20 years. I had over 100 employees, and I thought we were a family. I thought I was their friend. And I got to tell you, it was so fast how those relationships dropped and changed when I sold the club that nobody wanted to be around me. I was just the frickin' boss, and they were nice to me because I was the boss and paying them, and that was it. And I was crushed just a little bit, Ross.
And, you know, that's the nature of this thing, you know? Those are the lessons we learned. But anyway, what happened was when Jan got sick, and she got diagnosed in December of 84. My son was born in February of 85.
That's Nash, right?
And yeah. So around that time, it was very difficult for me. And I had no other way to make money. And I was doing, I did my stand up, but I was finding that I was taking a rather heavy mood up on stage with me. Okay.
Well, sure. You were dealing with a lot. Yeah.
I came up with the idea of, well, why don't I work like as a character? And I was watching the Masters in 1985, and Curtis Strange, he didn't win, but he was in the lead for a while. Okay?
Yeah, he's a good golfer, right?
And I just said, Curtis Strange, what a great name, Strange. I've never heard anybody named Stranger, but his name is Strange. And then I started to try and put up first names with it, and they all sounded phony. And going with Eddie, my father's name is Ed. And I decided to work as Eddie Strange. So I completely shifted my career and sold myself as Eddie Strange.
Oh, that's interesting. And how did it work for you?
Well, it worked great. I mean, it's like all of a sudden I was more free on stage. I was behind this mask of this character. I ended up becoming really big on colleges for about 2 years. Everything went fine. And then I had a... at some point, the break between reality and this character and everything cracked. I was working out in Hawaii, for Bob Fisher had a gig out there, mm-hmm. and I'm not able to bring it. And the act in front of me was, and he was just destroying. And I didn't have it in me. And I remember the people at the club pulling me into the kitchen and going, listen, I don't know what you're doing out there, but this is not what we paid for you to do. Because I was doing my act, but I just didn't have the energy. I didn't have the zip. I was just completely down. I remember saying to them, you know, I said, I'm sorry. I said, this is all I got. This is who I am, and this is what I do. And they weren't happy with the rest of the week there. And the thing is, they were paying, this was one of those gigs where they paid you $500, but you're in Hawaii.
Right,
they flew you out, but it's only $500. And it's like, they're busting my balls over, you know, for basically a $500 gig. And I get it, okay, but they were not happy. And, of course, Bob Fisher wasn't happy because he was the one who booked it.
But still, Ross, the character Eddie Strange gave you, as you pointed out, a mask to help you get through a couple tragic years after the death of Jan and help you cope. And I think that I was not aware of that. I knew that you had developed this character and you were doing something different. But I was young and dumb and didn't realize the emotional reason for it. I just thought, you know, I had a lot of comics that said, well, you know, I want to try this. And I loved letting people try different things.
Sure.
And because it helped grow the club or in the comic artistically. And so I didn't put any emotional value to what you were doing. I didn't get it. But I'm glad that you had it and it worked for you. And the fact that it fell off while in Hawaii, well, tough.
So eventually, by 88 or 89, I'm just me doing under a different name. And I said, you know, if I'm going to do that, I might as well go back to Ross Bennett. So I went back to Ross Bennett. These were not good choices, career choices, okay? Because it made it so people just like, you know, this guy's nuts, which I was. And I worked as Ross Bennett. And I moved around a lot. I ended up out in Chicago in the early 90s. And I was getting work on the East Coast, but the one guy said, he said, now listen, I ain't got no work for Ross Bennett, but I would hire Eddie Strange. Okay. And so I opted to go back to Eddie Strange a second time.
Because of the persona that you provided on stage worked.
Well, more about the name, because there were people who knew it. And I went through my act. I took all my best bits, and I didn't do the character as I did it before. I just did myself. And this is right around the time that the boom was beginning to bust. Okay.
Early to mid-90s.
Right. And what I did is I started going over to England. So like 92 and 2000, I made about a dozen trips over to England. I'd say anywhere from a month to 6 months. And that saved my ass. The money kept, you know, there was, whatever I earned was being sucked into expenses. But I just knew the important thing was to get through this and to keep performing, to not to not lose those chops that you developed only by working the amount that I worked.
Well, I think it's interesting that you share that, because I did a little research before the podcast, and there is this kind of blank zone in your career, because I know you did a lot of stand-up for me and other clubs up through the early 90s. Then there's kind of a gap, and then I know you were back at it in 2000 and getting Letterman and moving on with your career, and there was kind of an eight-year gap. And what's interesting is I just interviewed Kelly Monteith, and he was saying how the audiences in Europe and England particularly were so receptive to American entertainers. I'm sure that helped boost your ego and what you needed to get back into the Ross Bennett show.
I had forgotten how good my material was. Frankly, a lot of the club audience that we had started to dumb down in the States. Okay.
That's true.
And I remember one time I was headlining at Zany's in Vernon Hills and doing, you know, to their audience there. What's his name? Headliner Jake Johansson. He came in on Saturday night and he headlined and I middled. Okay. But all of a sudden I walk out on that stage. I've never seen these people before. This is a completely different audience. They dress better. They smell better. They drink better. They're bathed. Their hair's combed. They look great, and they're all like college educated, smart. And all of a sudden, my material is hitting in a way it hadn't hit all week. The kind of audiences, the club audiences that I would be getting, for the most part, weren't necessarily. I was doing. I got my laughs. I did my show. I had my big finish. I always had a big finish. It just became rote. Okay.
Right. Right.
I go over to England and the audiences fucking loved me, and they were really, and they admired what I did.
Well,
and they talked about my material, and I had forgotten that my stuff was all really well-crafted material.
And you'd honed it over, you know, all those years. I think that a lot of entertainers forget, or sometimes get, in your case, distracted by losing your wife. You lose some of that focus on what you were working on and building on. Eddie Strange was a bit of a vacation, and now you're back to finding the audience and finding your act the way it was. Now, do you have any particular memories of working Laughs Unlimited? Did you work with anybody extra fun?
In 2000 is when I moved to the New York City area, and I went back to Ross Bennett, and I've been there for 20 years, and I'm going to stay there. And so if anybody was interested in me, you look up Ross Bennett on Facebook or my website, rossbennett.com, you'll find out all about me. Okay,
there you go. We can book Ross Bennett today.
That's right. Laughs Unlimited, one of the best memories I had, I'd become a headliner. I was headlining up there. And Kevin Meaney was the middle act. And he was just so delightful.
Oh, great guy.
He was just so delightful. He had not achieved his level of celebrity yet. But he was just playful and fun and funny material. I remember two jokes of his. One of them was about his father not having a map in the car. He had a globe. Okay.
Okay.
And the other one was about how kids are always going in the backyard, digging a hole to China. They always say, go dig a hole to China. And he goes, I burned my hands on the mantle.
Trying to get to China. Kevin Meaney was a strange guy, but very funny. Came from his writing and his material from a different direction. Very San Francisco, very unique.
Yeah, he was.
Andy Kindler was the same. There was a few guys that came from that batch.
A lot of San Francisco comics, they were all very unique. A lot of them very odd. And a lot of them couldn't work outside of San Francisco. They couldn't. It was just too big a challenge.
Yeah, you needed some mainstream kind of vanilla. I hate to put it that way, but you needed.
You had to. I always took pride in the fact when I lived in L.A. and I started going out and working in, you know, the Punchline in Atlanta, your club, Dallas, the Comedy Spot, the Comedy Works in Denver. I always took pride that I could play around the country. I was not a regional act. I could do a good job every place. And at that time, the only place I couldn't do a good job was the East Coast, the Northeast. It was intimidating to me. And so when I moved to this area in 2000, that was my, I've been working for 20 years. I've worked for 22, 23 years. And that was my last hurdle, was I wanted to get so I could knock it out of the park at the comic strip, you know? Well, and I did, and I ended up working at the Comedy Cellar for 7 years. And I got so I could really pound out a set in Manhattan. And that's what got me the Letterman show.
Well, that's cool. And I want to hear about New York. But before we leave Laughs Unlimited, I got to share with you one story to tell me. I need you to tell me if it's true or not. My partner, Bob Stobener, was picking up a headliner. And this is real early on in the early 80s. And he said he got to the condo, which I think was at the apartment at Governor Square. And he said he walked in. And Ross Bennett was lying spread eagle on the floor naked, vegging. And both Bob and the headliner just kind of looked at you, stepped over you, and went back to the room. I mean, there was no interaction. It was, he said it was the most bizarre thing. Now, do you remember that? Was that you?
First off, I would not have been naked. He was, whatever it was, he was, what would you call it? He was embellishing the story, or he had a creative memory. However, I do vaguely remember at that time, I would have been, very much a pothead and very much, drinking quite a bit. So I have no doubts about that. And I sort of remember, that. I was not naked. That wouldn't be my style.
Well, I don't know. It was just,
I might've been in my underwear.
We were talking about you and what we remembered from your set and in Eddie Strange and the years you worked for us. And that was his recollection that, you were a opening or feature act at the time. And he was bringing in the headliner, and that was the welcome that the other act got. It was just a hilarious moment. Now I know that, since 2000, you've been really rocking the New York area. Have you been doing, I know you worked a lot of the clubs there. You mentioned a couple. Do you have some favorite clubs in the New York area you like to work?
I don't really work in the city anymore. Okay.
Okay.
I know a lot of people, you know, you go through stages in your career where you're in different places and eventually you grow out of places. You know, I feel that I aged out. Not that I don't look my age. There's so many young comics.
Right.
And
right.
When the spots started being there, and I used to work, six nights a week in the city, I worked mainly at the Comic Strip and at the Comedy Cellar, and it was great. It was great. And then it was so funny, right about the time I got Letterman, it all stopped.
Oh,
and
really?
It was really weird. It was really weird, you know? I mean, I advertised the comic strip on Letterman. He introduced me, you know, from the comic strip and everything. And that weekend, they didn't even use me on their stage.
What a missed opportunity.
Understood, you know, and there were people I know who were there because they had seen the show. That's just them, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm really not, I'm so grateful for what I got out of these clubs because it raised my game. I always looked at New York as being like a gym. Okay. It's a big gym and each of the clubs was like a different machine that somehow exercised a different comedy muscle. Okay.
Interesting.
And,
good analogy.
So I was very fortunate. I worked at all of them, some more than others. And then, but around 2003, I started getting some cruise work. And I did cruises off and on. I think I did 2.5 years total weeks, so like 150 weeks or 120 weeks.
That's a career right there.
From 2003 until 2007, until the beginning of 2017. Okay.
Wow, that's good
and,
work.
And that was good work for good. It was the best money a guy who's not a star can make other than corporate work, you know?
Now, what about...
Lot of comics... Huh?
I was just going to say, I did a little bit of research, and I know that you were teaching a little bit, teaching some writing skills.
Well, what it is I work at a place, Manhattan Comedy School.
Wait a minute, say that again, the Manhattan Comedy School?
Yeah, Manhattan Comedy School. That's their website and everything.
Wow.
And
didn't know it existed.
I started teaching in 2017. It's a 6-week course that I teach. I teach about 5 or 6 cycles a year. I've had great success with it. My students and I really connect. We needed to shift to online. I never thought I would do, I could never see doing it online. Okay. My online class is just booming. Okay. I've developed techniques to do with my class online that are extremely, extremely effective. And
wow.
That's my,
congratulations.
It's called Comedy Writing Bootcamp. And then I started a second class, which is all about how to perform stand-up comedy on Zoom comedy shows.
Well, that's interesting. That's one of the things I wanted to dig into was, were you trying to teach technique in being a comic? Because there's really there's two things you need to perform live, which is the techniques. How to hold a mic, how to interact with the audience, where to stand, what to look, and timing. Timing is so important. But then there's the writing side. And the writing side does have to come from the person, but somebody like you is able to teach the techniques to help you find your writing.
What I do in my writing class is, I have lectures each week. One of the lines I use is, we write jokes, but we create material. Okay?
Good word.
And the creation of material is because what we do as stand-ups, writing the joke is just the beginning. And then there's the honing that goes on, and it goes back and forth between performing and editing, performing and editing, going back and forth. And so I drive that into their noggin, and then I'm having them perform every week. So when I first took the class over, it was all about sitting around a table and writing. And I lasted about, and it's like, that's not going to happen. It's just boring. It was just horrible. And it was just painful for all of us. And I started to put in a graduation show, not to the public, but for each other. I just had them do their material. We did it the last week. And then I had them stand up. Afterwards, we do like a little round robin, and I tell them how they did for the week. And I remember I gave one guy, I said, that joke, try doing it this way. And he stood up, and I said, try, take that word off, try it again. And all of a sudden, the joke got right, okay? It got correct. And it just exploded in the room. Everybody felt it. And after the class, this guy said, he goes, I enjoyed your class. It was fine. But I'll tell you right now, if what you did with me for those 3 minutes is what the whole class was about, I would take it again tomorrow.
And he saw the value, yeah.
Just completely restructured the class. It's about writing and performance. And the Zoom performance class is, I watched a Zoom show and I was shocked that good comics looked so weak. They weren't well lit. The backgrounds were horrible. They had lights behind them that were destroying the exposure, and they were standing up. They were doing all these things that just made it so their performance was just tedious and uninteresting. And then one person, Ophira Eisenberg, went up and she just exploded. It was like everybody else is in 2D and she's in 3D Technicolor. And I said, I need a class specifically about this.
Well, you caught on to something that was really needed. Now,
right.
It's the Manhattan School of Comedy, because what's nice about being online is you don't have to be in Manhattan to take it, right?
Hold on. Oh, yeah, but it's the Manhattan Comedy School.
Manhattan Comedy School. I just wanted to get the plug correct. So if anybody listening to this wanted to take your course and learn about comedy writing and performance, they can sign up the next session that you do.
They need to have some experience. Okay. I don't have people who, but the first class, if they have no experience, is with Karen Berggren, wonderful comic. And she handholds them and gets them so they have an act. Okay. So when they come to me, if they haven't done anything else at her class, at least they have an act they can start working from.
You're like phase two. You're like,
I would
okay,
say that.
You've got a kernel of information. Now let's blossom it into an act.
And the performance class, which like I'm going to do the next one for that when it starts in mid-January, is all about how do I, because I go on the assumption, Scott, the way the world is right now, it's always going to be like this. Okay. And I'm not going to wait until things get back to normal and then put my life on hold or my career on hold until then.
Right.
So
right.
I decided to, I'm going to assume that this is the way it is. And I want to look as good as I can when I perform on these shows.
Okay? Well, you're adapting and that's those that adapt are the ones that succeed. I mean, that's been proven over and over in history. If you don't adapt, you die.
The other great thing about these performances that we do on these Zoom shows is it's a combination of stand up and broadcast. Okay.
I can see that.
Because you're playing to a camera.
Right.
And I'm telling my students that so many of the skills that we hone performing on the in front of the camera on these Zoom shows will transfer over to broadcasting work, because some of the best jobs for comics have been broadcasting. You know, you segue into a talk show, or you get yourself so you're doing a bit on the Daily Show. You know, like Lewis Black did. You know. And
or
all
even
about
a sitcom.
Interacting. Right. Well, the sitcom isn't broadcast.
I know,
sitcom
but I was just saying that you're teaching can open up a lot of doors.
Right. But specifically, sitcoms is about acting in front of a camera. Okay. The Zoom shows is really about more broadcasting. It's about performing stand-up directly to the camera lens.
I think it's impressive that you've been able to adapt and grow. And, you know, it's interesting as we listen to this podcast, Ross, is that you've transformed yourself through your career, much like a person's life. As things happen and change with age and time, you've been able to adapt and adjust. And in some cases, what life threw at you forced you into unique situations. But you found a way to stay true to yourself and to the art form. And here you are in your 60s, still involved in stand-up comedy. And I think that's something that you should be really proud of. And I think your dad would be proud of.
The two things, number one, thank you. Thanks for all that. Is that, you know, I've been clean and sober for 33 years. It just taught me that it's like one day at a time. I got today. What am I going to do with my life today? Okay. I became willing to adapt a long, long time ago. And, you know, the other great thing is I have many irons in the fire. I get stand-up. The gigs I get are like really well-paying gigs, which are the kind of gigs that you have if you have an act that can go up and, you know, get a standing ovation in front of 700 people.
Yeah, good, you clean, have an act corporate like that, you know, act.
That's exactly it.
Corporate work and is so valuable.
I can do corporate. I can do, you know, I do... I've done churches. I do all sorts of, you know, conferences and stuff like that.
Well, that's awesome. Well, you know what? We've shared your path. And okay. What I'd like to do now is share some of your comedy. So, Ross, before I throw into a comedy set of yours, I've got a nice 4-minute set lined up to let people hear what you were like on stage. This is an older set, so I know you've gone through a lot of transformations. I was just going to say, as somebody that's now teaching about comedy, you've had these 40 years of experience as a stand-up comic and, like me, somebody that appreciates and loves the art form. Before we end this podcast and pass it off to a comedy set, is there anything you'd like to share to our listeners about stand-up comedy and what it's meant to you?
I will say that it probably saved my life, okay, because it gave a guy who was sort of lost, didn't know what he wanted to do, something that to aspire to and to become good at and to make a living with, you know? I'll tell you one thing is it keeps you young. It keeps you, I love the creative process. I've been able, you know, there's one guy, I'll tell you one thing. I got an email about 10 years ago from a guy, and he said, I was going to kill myself. I'm not making this up. I have the email. He said, I was going to kill myself. I was so depressed. I was in Colorado Springs and I'm driving around trying to figure out how I'm going to do it, where I'm going to do it. And I saw the sign that said, the comedy spot, whatever it was in Colorado Springs. And he said, Eddie Strange. And he goes, I came in and I watched the show and it changed my life.
Wow.
And he then went on to say that he ended up becoming a comic. He worked, you know, as a comic for a number of years. You know, it's like, you never know. One reason I always go up and I always do the best show I can is that you never know who's watching you and what impact you can have on people.
Well, that's a great story, Ross. Thanks for sharing that. And it's so true that what we do in our lives, but also on stage entertaining people, can have an effect far reaching than we realize. And that's a great way to end this. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today and sharing some of your story. Ladies and gentlemen, be sure to check out the Manhattan School of Comedy. Did I get that right?
No, the Manhattan Comedy School.
You know, they'll find it. And look for Ross Bennett and his classes. You guys, thanks for listening. But Ross, thanks so much for sharing your time. We're going to sit back and enjoy some stand-up comedy. Ladies and gentlemen, here's some material by our star interviewee today, Ross Bennett.
Because we are real Americans. And real Americans live close to Walmart. It's hard not to. It's hard not to. I mean, statistically, 85% of Americans live within 15 minutes of a Walmart. Isn't that an amazing number? We live within 15 minutes of a 24-hour store. Anything we want in America, 24 hours a day. We're Americans. And let's be honest, sometimes we wake up and we need shit. We sit up in our beds. Oh, God. Woo! Roofing nails. I can't wait. I said I can't wait, woman. Don't hold me back. Anyone like me, sometimes when I shop at a Walmart, I don't know what I need until I'm in the store. Because I don't shop like my parents shopped. My parents were very frugal people. They had gone through the Great Depression. I look out here and I see there's some people here who look like they were from my parents' generation. Actually, some of you look like you might have actually caused the Great Depression. But my parents' generation, when they went shopping, they always would make a list. They didn't just buy what they wanted. They made a list. And when they had, they had to have cash. They wouldn't use a credit card. They didn't use a credit card. They saved their money. When they had enough money, they'd take the money and the list to the store, and they would only purchase what was on the list. See, when I go shopping, a little different. When I go shopping, I don't have a list. I have an hour. I grab a cart. Let's see what happens. Next thing, I'm in the checkout line. I look in my cart. It's like coming to out of an alcoholic blackout. I don't know what the hell I was thinking of. Woo! Got like a six-pack of bacon-flavored Maalox. Tube socks, weed whackers. I got stuff I don't need. I got a nursing bra. And a canoe. And this is when I'll often abandon my shopping cart. And who amongst us has not abandoned a shopping cart? Because they're all over the store. Oh, Lord, half full carts. They should have little plaques. This is where a shopper came to his senses.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that. That was Ross Bennett live on stage. Hey, it's been a great interview and a little bit of comedy. I know you enjoyed it. Thanks for being a listener. Thanks for sharing and rating our podcast. And we'll see you next week when we'll have another new show. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.